This is the sixth day of this October 2017 seven-day session. And we'll return to the teachings of 12th century Chinese Zen master Da Wei. Warning from him. Once you have achieved peaceful stillness of body and mind, you must make earnest effort. Do not immediately settle down in peaceful stillness. In the teachings, this is called the deep pit of liberation, much to be feared. It's so tempting, late in Sesshin, after having worked so hard and finding perhaps some relief from the storms one has weathered, to settle into a quiet, very deep calm. Very enticing. But to do so is to kind of settle for that. It's is to kind of wrap things up. And instead to press on, to not be satisfied with this luscious quietness, and just right in the midst of that stillness, to look, to question. If one's practice is a koan, to question can make all the difference, can change one's life. There's a Chinese master, Po Shan, who put it this way: once those who have lived amidst the noise and restlessness of worldly affairs experience the joy of quietness, they become captivated by its honey-sweet taste, craving it like an exhausted traveler who seeks a peaceful den in which to slumber. How can people with such an attitude retain their awareness? There's nothing wrong with it. It's not in the realm of right and wrong. It's just selling oneself short. Back to Da Hui, he says, you must make yourself turn freely like a gourd floating on the water, independent and free, not subject to restraints, entering purity and impurity without being obstructed or sinking down. Only then do you have a little familiarity with the school of the patch-robed monks. If you just manage to cradle the uncrying child in your arms, what's the use? Cradling the uncrying child in your arms might be blissful, satisfying. But let that child awake. This is another letter. He writes, this affair is like the bright sun in the blue sky, shining clearly, changeless and motionless, without diminishing or increasing. It shines everywhere in the daily activities of everyone, appearing in everything. Though you try to grasp it, you cannot get it. Though you try to abandon it, it always remains. It is vast and unobstructed, utterly empty. Like a gourd floating on water, it cannot be reined in or held down. Since ancient times, when good people of the way have attained this, they've appeared and disappeared in the sea of birth and death, able to use it fully. There is no deficit or surplus. Like cutting up sandalwood, each piece is it. Most infinitesimal speck is it fully. Nothing lacking, nothing in excess. In the koan in the Mumonkan, Mumon says, you describe it in vain, you picture it to no avail. You can never praise it fully. Stop all your groping and maneuvering. There is nowhere to hide your true self. When the universe is annihilated, it remains indestructible. Groping and maneuvering, you could see as grasping, trying to figure out this matter. It can't be figured out. It's never been figured out. And there's no need to figure it out. Just want to be it. When we are fully this practice that we're working on, then we understand it, but not with the intellect. There's no need to understand it with the intellect. Continues, when people of power, and really this is every one of us, no one is without this innate power, this mind. It's a matter of bringing it forth. When people of power want to investigate this one great affair to the end, they break down their facades and with bold spirit draw their spines up straight. Do not go along with the feelings of others. Take your own constant point of doubt and stick it on your forehead. That is, hold it clearly in the mind. This koan or inquiry. Always be as if you owed someone millions with nothing to repay with when pressed for payment, fearful of humiliation by others. Only thus will you have some direction in the task of finding urgency where there is no urgency, getting busy where there is no pressure, and finding importance where there is no importance. So this would be kind of ordinary sitting, what the Japanese call bonpu zen, safe and uneventful sitting, just kind of a tranquilizing sitting, where there's no urgency, no pressure, no importance, but to lift it beyond that, to bring forth what is underneath, within us somewhere, this need to know. When the need becomes strong enough, we will know. And every time we do any kind of earnest zazen, we are nurturing that need, we're strengthening it, we're empowering it. But he continues, work diligently day and night, while eating and drinking, when joyful or angry, in clean places or unclean places, in family gatherings, when entertaining guests, when dealing with official business in your post, when concluding a betrothal. All of these are first-class times to make efforts to arouse and alert yourself and awaken. He's leaving no excuses for those who would say, oh, I don't have time. In the old days, the military governor, Li Wenho, was able to practice Chan and attain great penetration and great enlightenment while in the thick of wealth and rank. When Yang Wenkung successfully practiced Chan, he was dwelling in the Imperial Academy. When Chang Wuqin practiced Chan, he was the Minister for Transport in Kiangxi. These three elders are examples of this, not destroying the worldly aspect while speaking of the real aspect. And that Da Wei continues, pressing, when has it ever been necessary to leave wife and children, quit one's job, chew on vegetable roots, and cause pain to the body? This would be the warning of people who is sort of kind of a romantic type of person who thinks they have to go all the way, do it old school, become an ordained, become monks, withdraw from human contact, and live like a hermit. Those of inferior aspiration shun clamor and seek quietude. In so doing, they enter the ghost cave of dead tree chan, entertaining false ideas that only thus can they awaken to the path. He continues, if you can manage not to forget the matter of birth and death while in the midst of the passions of the world, then even though you do not immediately smash the lacquer bucket, nevertheless you will have planted deep the seed wisdom of transcendental knowledge, prajna wisdom. In another lifetime you will appear and save your mental power. You won't fall into evil dispositions. You'll overcome that sinking down into the defilement of passion. Let's go back over this. He says, if you can manage not to forget the matter of birth and death while in the midst of the passions of the world, if you can maintain awareness, in other words, if it's a koan you're working on, if you can maintain awareness of the koan in the midst of daily life, the koan being an expression of that which is beyond birth and death. then even though you do not immediately smash the lacquer bucket, this is referring to realization, enlightenment, the bottom of the bucket falling out, nevertheless, you will have planted deep the seed wisdom of prajna, bodhi wisdom. In another lifetime, you'll appear. You won't fall into evil dispositions. This would be the lower of the six realms of unenlightened existence. The Chinese masters, more than the Japanese, I think, from the texts we have that have been translated into English, the Chinese masters are more frank about how, even if you don't do it this lifetime, if you don't come to awakening in this lifetime, you will have positioned yourself. You have set yourself up for doing so more likely in the next lifetime. They acknowledge that possibility that it won't happen in this lifetime. But for all we know, this is the lifetime that we're set up for. This is the chance. It may not get better than this lifetime. This is our chance. And he continues urging this householder not to make excuses. He says, as a gentleman of affairs, as a householder, your practice of the way differs greatly from mine as a home leaver, a monk. Leavers of home do not serve their parents, and they abandon all their relatives for good. With one jug and one bowl in daily activities according to circumstances, there are not so many enemies to obstruct the path. With one mind and one intent, home leavers, just investigate this affair thoroughly. But when a householder opens his eyes and is mindful of what he sees, there is nothing, there is not an enemy spirit blocking the path. If he has wisdom, he makes his meditational effort right there. And he quotes Vimalakirti, this great enlightened Indian layperson. As Vimalakirti said, the companions of passion are the progenitors of the Tathagatas. I fear that people will destroy the worldly aspect to seek the real aspect. And then he also made a comparison. Apparently, he's still quoting Vimalakirti. It's like the high plateau not producing lotus flowers. It is the mud of the low-lying marshlands that produces these flowers. The mud being the struggles, the temptations of worldly life. It's those conditions that produce these exquisite flowers. He continues, if you can penetrate through right here, as those three elders, he refers again to those three guys. If you can penetrate right there, your power will surpass that of us home leavers by 20-fold. What's the reason? We home leavers are on the outside breaking in. Householders are on the inside breaking out. The power of one on the outside breaking in, that's a monk, is weak. The power of one on the inside breaking out is strong. Strong means that what is opposed is heavy, so in overturning it there is power. Weak means what is opposed is light, so in overturning it there is little power. Though there is strong and weak in terms of power, what is opposed is the same. Again, encouraging householders to use the opportunity they have and not to make excuses. We have our own kind of hybrid version of a kind of semi-monastic training on staff, residential training at the center, where there are a lot of things that are simplified. You have no choice but to sit every day, sometimes two or three times a day. That's all in part of the schedule and makes it easier, of course. There's no choice but to sit. There's a lot of silence, discipline at the center. These are the conditions that would make awakening easier without as many obstacles. But that too, one cannot take advantage of those things. And when there's no resistance, then a kind of slackness can work into the system. Whereas householders who have all kinds of ways that throughout the day and night where they're chafing against others, maybe at work and with family, teenagers, kids. This is a great kind of sanding, effect of sanding off one's sense of self, one's idea about private space, or it involves sacrifice. But even on staff at the center, there is not the such strictness that one doesn't still have temptations to face outside of the center, and even within, the temptation to talk too much, dwell in idle chatter, and how to manage that if one doesn't want to waste one's time that way. It's a kind of forces people on staff to really face what it is they're doing there, what they really want. And requires that they bring forth some self-discipline from within. Here's another letter to a different person. He says, "There has never been anything to give to people, only folks who have been able to point out the road for others." He's talking about selling water by the river. "An ancient worthy said, 'Having some attainment is the jackal's yelp, having no attainment is the lion's roar.'" This is one of my favorite warnings about clinging to any sense of having achieved something in practice. Having some attainment, in other words, thinking of oneself as having attained something, is the jackal's yelp. But to be free of any sense of having attained anything is the lion's roar. Goes on, "Buddha was someone who had mastered adaptation. In the course of 49 years, in more than 360 assemblies where he taught the Dharma. He guided people according to their individual faculties. Thus he taught with one voice through all realms, while sentient beings each obtained benefits according to their kind. And then he quotes a Chinese saying, it's like one gust of the east wind and the myriad grasses all bend down. The Dharma taught by the Buddha is also like this. The scholars who are hearing this Taisho will notice that when Da Wei says 49 years, the Buddha taught for 49 years, that doesn't square with all the accounts. The accounts say that after his enlightenment, he taught for 45 years. It just shows that Da Wei, like many of the masters, was not a stickler for details. 49 is one of those numbers in Buddhism that are easy to use to draw out. 49 is 7 times 7. 7 is a big number in Buddhism, as it is in some other religious traditions. And then even his 360, that's another one where the conventional speech, say we have 360 bones and 84,000 pores. It just became a way to refer to these kind of numbers without being sticklers for precision. The same thing about 49 is with rebirth. The teaching is that rebirth usually takes place within 49 days, but that too is not to be taken literally. Says another letter. He's quoting someone because it's in quotation marks, but again, he doesn't attribute it to anyone in particular. Here's the quote: Buddha taught all doctrines to save all minds. I have no mind at all, so what's the use of any doctrines? No mind, no thoughts, no attachment to ideas, concepts. And then Da Wei himself says, basically there is nothing in any doctrine and no mind in mind. The emptiness of mind and things both is their real character. We have these lines in Affirming Faith in Mind that we chant. Things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. And then elsewhere, these two are merely relative, and both at source are emptiness. So in other words, we're immersed in emptiness. It's not some other realm, like the space between figures in a drawing, or like outer space. Form is only emptiness. He says, but these days students of the way often fear falling into emptiness. Those holding such views misapprehend expedient means and take the disease for the medicine. The medicine, what is really emptiness is really medicine. It's not anything to be feared. And therefore, Layman Pong said, don't be averse to falling into emptiness. Falling into emptiness isn't bad. He also said, just vow to empty all that exists. Don't make real that which doesn't exist. Now this has got a lot in there. Just vow to empty all that exists. Okay, it's not really something, a matter of our emptying it, but to see it as having always all things as being no thing. All phenomena as being nothing, without substantiality. And the other half of that is, don't make real that which doesn't exist. Concepts, ideas, notions, thoughts, principles. So many people are dominated by concepts, ideals. We don't really need to ideals to live an upright life. Ideals are ideas. And so much suffering has been caused by people trying to advance their ideals. He continues, if you can see through this one saying, that is, to empty all that exists and don't make real that which doesn't exist, then the ignorance born of boundless evil deeds will instantly melt away and disperse. Even the whole great Buddhist canon taught by the Tathagata cannot explain this one sentence. Those who are actually practicing, of course, everyone here in Sesshin, anyone who's practicing, they don't have to worry about this kind of agenda of emptying all that exists. It happens on its own when we're really fully concentrated on the practice. That's the emptying. To think that our job is to empty anything is just... adding something that isn't necessary. The emptying happens through the absorption in the practice. And it also, in the same way, it also helps us not make real that which doesn't exist. It helps us see through thoughts, concepts, ideas. Continues, if a person has certain faith and knows that there is such a method of great liberation, and if in that knowing he turns the key of transcendence, then Layman Pong's saying and the whole great canon taught by the Buddha are no different. Without before or after, ancient or modern, lack or excess. Such a person neither sees that any doctrines exist, nor sees that any minds exist. The world in all directions is empty and vast. But then he says, don't entertain the view of vast emptiness. Don't hold that in your mind, that things are empty, everything's empty. And it's just another idea. If you hold this view, then there is someone expounding emptiness and someone who hears emptiness being expounded. Then there are all doctrines to be heard and all minds to be experienced. once there is something to be heard and experienced, then within there is the realizing mind, and without there is a, then within there is the realizing mind, and without there is a dharma, in quotes, to be realized. Unless this disease is removed, the teachings call it expounding the dharma egotistically. It's also called slandering the Buddha, dharma, and sangha. And then he addresses the recipient of this letter. Disciple Chen, you have realized that personal existence is false and that things are illusory. Amidst illusory falsehood, you were able to contemplate the saying, a dog has no Buddha nature. Suddenly, while washing your face, you found your nose and sent me a letter expressing your understanding, trying your hand at explaining Chan. You know what he's going to say about that, trying to explain Zen. This was like a three-day-old tiger cub who already has the spirit to devour an ox. So he has the compassion, and it is compassion. He has the compassion and the concern for the student of his not to let him hold on to his ideas of having really attained anything. So he says, I admire your spirit. You're like a three-day-old cub who already has the spirit to devour an ox. But he says, the message conveyed therein, though, was like a lucky monkey hitting the ground with a stick. Where it hit, it went in a few inches, but where it missed, it had no grasp of the issue at all. That's a vivid image. See a monkey wielding a stick and randomly striking here and there. Though in the main your basis is already correct, you are not yet clear about the great Dharma. This is a common disease of beginners entering the path. Sounds like maybe he's saying, yeah, you got a little glimpse of your true nature. But don't stop there. And he continues, if you can realize such a thing, push it to one side and take the essential gate of all the Buddhas and patriarchs and shut it at once. Only if you find a life on the other side of the primordial Buddha will you gain mastery of the Dharma. It's just a great and daunting challenge for anyone who has had some first breakthrough, is to not leave it at that, not settle for that. And then he ends this letter by saying, just get the root. Don't worry about the branches. Over a long, long time, it will sink in thoroughly. Don't worry that you won't attain oneness. Work on it. And now, going to the middle of the next letter, he poses the questions, the questions of all questions. Where do we come from at birth? Where do we go at death? If you know where we come from and where we go, then you can be called a student of Buddha. Who is it who knows of birth and death? And who is it who experiences birth and death? Again, who is it who doesn't know where we come from and where we go? Who is it who suddenly realizes where he comes from and where he goes to? And who is it who, reading these words, blinks his eyes, unable to understand, his belly churning up and down as if a mass of fire were placed in his heart? If you want to know, just apprehend him at the point where he can't understand. If you can recognize him then, you'll know that birth and death surely have nothing to do with him. This is great advice. In our not knowing, in our confusion, he's turning it back to the subject. Who is that who doesn't know? Who is it who's confused? That's the source right there. Look there, where you are, into the not knowing, questioning. One last paragraph. He says, whenever you're reading the sutras or the stories of the ancient masters coming to awakening, when your mind doesn't understand clearly and it seems bewildering and stifling and flavorless, as if you're gnawing on an iron spike, this is just the time to apply effort. Above all, you must not give up. This is the place where conceptual knowledge doesn't operate, where thought doesn't reach, where discrimination is cut off and the path of reason is annihilated, where you can always explain reasons and apply discrimination. This all pertains to emotional consciousness. Let's just go over this again. This is so essential. Right there, where the koan, let's say, or a passage in a sutra where the koan seems so opaque and bewildering and stifling and flavorless, and you feel in working on the koan like you're gnawing on an iron spike, this is just the time to apply effort. Above all, you must not give up, he says. This is the very place where conceptual knowledge doesn't operate, where thought doesn't reach, where discrimination is cut off and the path of reason is annihilated. So the importance of just pressing on even when you feel like you're at an impasse, this is essential. Many people will just back off. They'll get discouraged. But that's the worst mistake. It's right there where it seems so impassable. That's where we have to persist, press forward. Remember that in working on a koan, we're not trying to come up with an answer as such. We don't want to be expecting an answer. Forget answers. It's just in the pure work of questioning itself. It's in the questioning itself. Forget answers. There's no better time than this last stage of Sesshin to really break through this impasse that one may feel. Wonderful opportunity here. Roshi Kapil used to say, to reach this point again would take you another 6 days of hard work in Sesshin. Take advantage of it. Don't retreat, don't rest. Stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attend.